From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the betrayal of American democracy. We talk with journalist William Grider. He says all you have to do is look at the presidential primaries to see how democracy is breaking down. That breakdown is the subject of his new book and new Frontline documentary to be shown tomorrow night on PBS. Actress Shelley Duvall was discovered by director Robert Altman. She's appeared in many of his films and starred in Stanley Kubrick's movie The Shining. But for the last few years, she's been producing children's series for cable TV. Coming up, we talk with her about all of the above. And Maureen Carrigan takes us where few women dare to roam. She reviews West of Everything, The Inner Life of Westerns. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Approved by the United Nations Security Council. The sanctions, which include an embargo on air links and arms sales to Libya, were approved last month after Libya refused to hand over two men charged in connection with the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. The Security Council is also demanding access to other Libyan agents suspected of taking part in the downing of a French plane over Africa in 1989. The two attacks killed 441 people. The sanctions are scheduled to take effect just after midnight tonight. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin appears to have reached a compromise with the Republic's parliament that will allow him to keep his powers to rule by decree. The Congress of People's Deputies has given preliminary approval to a resolution that would also allow Yeltsin's free market reforms to continue. Under the agreement, Yeltsin will be able to remain as his own prime minister for at least 3 months. The compromise averts the threatened resignation of Yeltsin's cabinet. Cabinet members will work through May 20th on measures to reduce some of the burden of the economic reforms, such as lowering taxes, raising wages, and providing some subsidies to industry. Czech President Václav Havel has announced that he'll run for a second term. The chief of state will be selected by parliament after a general election in June. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from Prague.
Václav Havel, the dissident playwright turned politician, was elected president only days after the 1989 revolution that toppled communism. The most charismatic of Eastern Europe's post-communist leaders, Havel told parliament today that his decision to run again was a tough one. He said he had learned how difficult it is to lead his country in the transition from communism to democracy. He presented a 15-point program that stresses the importance of human rights and combats nationalism, racism, and anti-Semitism. Speaking of the growing tension between Czechs and Slovaks, Havel conceded that he had not fully understood to what degree the Slovak people want to emancipate themselves from the central government in Prague. He proposed the creation of a loose federation of two sovereign states linked by a formal agreement. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Prague.
Federal mediators said today that the striking members of the United Auto Workers Union have agreed to return to work at Caterpillar Corporation. The agreement could end a 5-month walkout that has idled nearly 13,000 workers in Illinois. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 36 points to close at a record 3,306. This is NPR. Hotel executive Leona Helmsley lost an appeal for the reduction of her tax evasion sentence today. She's expected to report to a federal prison hospital in Kentucky tomorrow to begin serving a 4-year term. Earlier today, lawyers for the self-styled hotel queen had argued that her sentence may have been fair when it was imposed in 1989. They said Helmsley's health has deteriorated since then, however, to the point where 4 years could be a virtual life sentence. Prosecutors said the 71-year-old hotel owner remains an active woman and said the law would be mocked if she were allowed to avoid prison. Illinois Governor Jim Edgar declared the city of Chicago a disaster area today because of flooding that has shut down much of downtown Chicago over the past 2 days. NPR's Ira Glass reports.
The declaration doesn't commit the state to spending money repairing downtown Chicago. The state has no money, Edgar said today. But it clears the way for President Bush to declare Chicago a federal disaster area, which would mean loans and grants to rebuild the city. At an afternoon news conference, Chicago Mayor Richard Daley said today that the flooding disaster could have been avoided and fired his transportation commissioner, whose agency knew weeks ago that the old freight tunnels under Chicago were in danger of collapsing and flooding the city. Repairs to the city have gone slowly. More buildings will have their power restored before tomorrow morning, but dozens will still be dark. And draining the water from under Chicago could easily take 2 weeks, maybe more. I'm Ira Glass in Chicago.
House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt disclosed today that he wrote 28 bad checks on his account at the now-closed House Bank over a three-year period. The Missouri Democrat said he'd pay about $615 to the Treasury as penalties for his overdrafts. Gephardt released a report by an independent auditor that blamed part of his overdrafts on sloppy management at the bank, saying it failed to promptly credit deposits to his account. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The primary campaign season should be showing off American democracy at its best. Yet for many Americans, the campaigns are demonstrating what's wrong with American politics. My guest William Grider offers a diagnosis of our ailing political system in his new book, Who Will Tell the People? The Betrayal of American Democracy, and in a Frontline documentary that will be broadcast tomorrow evening on public television. Grider says the roots of democratic decay are deeper than the political personalities and the parties they represent. The whole relationship between the citizens and the government that represents them has been deformed. Grider is a former assistant managing editor at The Washington Post who now writes about politics for Rolling Stone. His earlier book, Secrets of the Temple, was about the Federal Reserve. Grider is critical of both political parties. He calls the Democrats the party of Washington lawyers.
The Democrats, if you look at the Democratic National Committee and just ask the simple question, what is this organization, you find that there's nothing there. There are no people there. It's a hollow shell of what the Democratic Party used to be. I think one of the most startling facts in my book is that I ask them, well, who are your regulars? Who are the people who send in a little check pretty much every year? And that group is only 100,000 people. Think of that, 100,000 people in a nation of 180 million. And here's the real shocker. The average age of those Democratic regulars is 70 years old. So you have an atrophied organization that no longer connects to people. And then you ask, well, who does connect things within this party? And it turns out to be a very narrow cadre of influential lawyers and lobbyists, most of whom served in government at one time or another or served alongside presidential candidates. And they broker, in a sense, among the different fiefdoms of the Democratic Party in Washington. Most of them represent corporate clients on issues that are often directly counter to the interests of the party's own constituencies. And the conflicts with labor are the most obvious ones, but there are many, many others. And on many issues, they are hostile, sometimes quite openly, to the grassroots constituencies. I mean, if you listen to the voices of the Democratic Party establishment, the so-called wise men, they are constantly lamenting the fact that women, blacks, other minority groups have too much influence over the Democratic Party. And if you listen to their dialogue, you would believe that the Democratic Party is somehow steered by this coalition of malcontented, marginalized citizens. I mean, it's ludicrous. It has nothing to do with the real governing agenda.
Okay, so you call the Democrats the party of Washington lawyers. You call the Republicans the party of mass marketing.
Yeah. The Republicans, if you say that the only purpose of politics is to hold power, then the Republican Party has been an enormously successful political organization in recent years because it figured out how to hold power, namely the presidency, in the midst of alienation. And it does that by posing as the party of the disaffected. It says, we're with all of those people who feel like they've been cut out, who feel powerless, and we share their resentments against those dirty elites. Now, those happen to be liberal elites, but the posture is quite effective. And in different ways over the last 20 years, really, Republicans have perfected that posture. They're in a bit of a collision with it this year, I think, because after all, they have had the presidency now for 12 years, and it becomes increasingly hard to gull people into believing that the George Bush is an outsider. Nevertheless, he's going to try again this year.
I think yesterday Bush said something like people should vote for him because they want change.
Right. He's the candidate of change. Well, if people swallow that, then they deserve whatever they get, I would say. But I don't want to get partisan in this diagnosis, because underneath that manipulation, and remember, Republicans, just by their nature, are the party of business and commerce. They always have been. And so they have a familiarity with the sort of big think mass market messages. It comes out of advertising and public relations. And I make the comparison in the book that if you look at the use of television by the Republican Party, its techniques and premises are really identical to the way commercial advertising operates on television.
Do you think that your critiques of the Democratic and Republican parties apply to each other? In other words, do you think that the Democrats are also the party of mass marketing,
yeah,
and that the Republicans are also the party of lawyers,
yeah,
and lobbyists?
And I could have analyzed both parties in exactly the same terms, but it would have been redundant to do so. But in fact, that's a good point, Terry, that the Republican Party has the same hierarchy and the same disconnection from its constituencies. They have an elite which in many ways is much more removed than the Democratic elite operating in Washington. And likewise, the Democrats are trying, and each year they try again, to emulate the mass marketing manipulation that the Republican Party knows so well. There's one other important point to make about the Republicans. The Republicans have not governed in the last 12 years as a party of conservative ideology. What they have done is govern in behalf of conservative clients.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is that, yes, they are for less government unless one of their important client groups wants the government to intervene. And in that case, they want more government. And there are a million examples of this. The one that's played out most spectacularly for the taxpayers is the financial crisis. They want the marketplace to decide things until major Republican banks are in trouble. Then they want a program of sort of managed intervention in which the federal government props up those banks, changes the rules, puts some money on the table courtesy of the taxpayers, to recapitalize those banks and so forth and so on. So what I'm arguing is that this is a party that trots out a banner of laissez-faire, small government, and in fact governs quite differently in behalf of the needs of its clients.
Do you think that the Democratic and Republican party machinery have lost control of the candidates? And I'm thinking, like, in this election, you know, the Democratic National parties had to step in and ask Jerry Brown to kind of tone it down a little on Bill Clinton. I don't think the Republican Party is very happy at having Pat Buchanan doing so well in the early primaries.
Yeah, but that's true. But as you might guess, my sympathies are with the insurgents. Who are the party bosses? Ron Brown is chairman of the Democratic Party, is a decent guy and all that, but he's a lobbyist for one of these big law firms I'm talking about. What Democratic voters is he connected to? Who does he represent? Who is he accountable to? And you can ask exactly the same kinds of questions about the so-called leaders in the Republican Party. I mean, every year or every election year, there's this perennial lament that, well, these are unsatisfactory candidates and the people should have shut up and let the leaders pick them. Well, who are the leaders? I mean, one of the central points of my book is that both of those political organizations we call the major parties have lost their connections to real constituencies of voters.
So many people are disenchanted with the choices in the primaries. So what do you think has determined which candidates have emerged as the leading candidates, especially in the Democratic Party, where it's been something of a free-for-all?
Well, the overly simple answer is money and media.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at 1984, 1988, and 1992, you see the same pattern. The candidate who prevailed was the one who raised the biggest bucks first. Bill Clinton did that. And Bill Clinton, I don't want to disparage him. He has his own assets as a politician and a candidate and so forth. But the fact is, he went to this same infrastructure of lawyers, lobbyists, special interests, Washington establishment, and persuaded them over a number of years that he was a safe, reliable Democratic candidate for president. And they gave him lots of money. He then began early to impress the big media, mainly based in Washington, with his seriousness and reliability as a candidate. And so last January, long before any of us had really focused on any of these people, and the general public barely knew that that the season had begun, if you looked at the media, they would say, Bill Clinton is the putative front runner. He looks like the best candidate, and there was a lot of ink spilled on what a wonderful candidate Bill Clinton was. One of the reasons the media was convinced of that is because Bill Clinton had raised more money than anybody else, and somehow that made him more responsible or real than, say, Tom Harkin of Iowa or Bob Kerry or whoever. So you see what I mean? You've started a destructive process in which other possibilities get closed out before the game is started. Now, in the end, that process ends up damaging Clinton himself because the race is settled within a couple of months and the media has nothing left to do except pummel Clinton some more, and that's what we've seen.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is journalist William Grider, author of the new book, Who Will Tell the People? The Betrayal of American Democracy. And that betrayal of American democracy is also the subject of a Frontline documentary that he produced that will be shown Wednesday evening on public television. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist William Grider is my guest. Getting back to the subject of, how the betrayal of American democracy goes beyond what we're seeing in the primaries and in the election process, you say what we've become is a mock democracy, that in a way we have all the trappings of free and open political discourse, but the system is guided at a deep level by powerful interests. Let me get you to elaborate on that.
Well, I mean, when I say mock democracy, has all the trappings of free and open debate. The problem is that it is defined by who has the resources, that is money, to play at that level. And if you enter the debate on almost any subject in Washington, it is circumscribed by experts of various kinds, most of whom have been put in the field by powerful interests. Now, it is true there are some experts speaking in for so-called public interest groups or environmental groups and so on. But the landscape of our contemporary political debate in Washington is overwhelmingly populated by the representatives, whether they're lawyers, lobbyists, think tank policy analysts, economists, scientists, on and on and on, who have been put there by basically corporate interests, trade associations, and others whose organized money is at play in politics.
Well, you're criticizing the think tanks in part for defining the debate. What's wrong with think tanks? I mean, They're scholars from top universities and former people who were formerly affiliated with top universities at these think tanks who have the time to carefully research and analyze complex problems. Isn't that an asset for democracy?
Well, I would say, of course, the more I believe in the multitude of voices, and the more the merrier. But I think when you see, for instance, somebody quoted from AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, or CISS, what is that, the Center for International Strategic Studies, or the Heritage Foundation, as they're quoted ad nauseum in newspaper accounts of what of policy issues, and they appear on television all the time, instead of identifying them as an academic policy analysis analyst, I would like to see this sort of ID run brought to you courtesy of IBM, General Electric, General Motors, Ford, Chase Manhattan Bank, Citicorp, AT&T, and so forth, because that's why they're in the debate. These are not disinterested policy analysts. They've been hired by these tax-exempt think tanks to be present in the policy debate and to churn out various expert studies.
In your analysis of the press, you say that relations have become too cozy between the press and the politicians. And you give examples of reporters who play tennis with people in the cabinet and reporters who are married to people on the fringes of government and so on. But it's ironic if you think it's a time when the press is becoming particularly cozy with politicians. It's also a time that the press is going after politicians in a way that it never has before. So yeah. How do you explain that contradiction?
Well, what are they going after? They're going after Bill Clinton, who is not in power, and Jerry Brown, who is not only not in power, but they're quite sure won't be in power. And they may be going after George Bush on some personal questions. What they are not doing in any consistent, coherent way is challenging the assertions of those in authority on the real issues of government. And I will give you the most spectacular example, but there are scores of others. In 1988, when every insider in Washington knew, and I know this because I was talking to him at the time, that right after the election, there was going to be a huge taxpayer bailout of the savings and loan industry. This was not a well-kept secret, believe me. And yet it never got – it not only didn't get communicated to the public at large, but it never was brought up as a challenge to either George Bush or Michael Dukakis during the campaign. That's a huge failure of the press.
And now they're doing it
again this year
with
the crisis in commercial banking.
Mm-hmm.
And the facts are a little more complicated, but I've talked to these same people. They're lobbyists and they're people in Congress. Again, it doesn't take a super sleuth investigative reporter to figure out that right after this election, the American taxpayers are going to be told sometime next year that, well, it seems that you're going to have to pay for the commercial bank bailout as well because the banks can't pay for it. I mean, I've seen the memos. They're already written of how that issue will be dealt with. And it just won't be brought up in the election year.
I know that you're critical of the press for focusing on character issues at the expense of larger political issues. But this is the second election in a row where we've heard rumors that there is a story that could break about George Bush having had an affair. And I wonder if you have any insights into who's doing what behind the scenes to try to get that story and if you think there is a story.
Terry, I know the same rumors and gossip that all other insiders in Washington know and have heard it for years. And I cannot attest that they are true or false. I also believe, at least my impression is, that a number of news organizations have spent some energy, maybe a lot of energy, over the last, certainly in 1988 and before, trying to establish whether indeed George Bush had a mistress. And I don't want to trot through the bloody details of the rumors because I think that's unfair to George Bush and to the woman involved. It's fairly depressing, though, if you step back and think about it, that we are now going to judge fairness in media attention in this election year to whether they stick the president with the same adulterous charge that that his opponent has been labeled. I mean, I'm sorry. I think that's going further downhill, even though I'm for fairness, too.
I know one of the things that irritates you is to see celebrities endorsing causes and becoming spokespeople for causes. I think that's the larger irritant.
Well, irritates the wrong word.
Okay.
I mean, that's become a major venue of politics, and I don't disparage those celebrities. I somewhere in the book I make the point that if you wanted a real critique of the Reagan era, it didn't come from the Democratic Party or from the media. It came from Hollywood and the celebrity entertainers who I think with some courage stood up and said, we think making war against Nicaragua is wrong, or we think homelessness is wrong, and so forth. You know, I mean, I don't knock those people. I admire them. The problem, however, is that celebrities, even the ones I admire, still leave the voters in a kind of passive audience role. And that's why my complaint really is that celebrity politics can only go so far in a very limited way in mobilizing people for that reason.
Do you know what your Frontline documentary is up against on TV tomorrow?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, it's...
We're not going to mention it, though, right, Terry?
Well, no, actually, we are. The program is called What About Me? I'm Only Three. And the listing reads, Hollywood is banding together for a special look at our environment and our children. Celebrities offer information on the environment in response to questions from children. Celebrities include Lonnie Anderson, John Ritter, and host Ann Margaret.
Ah, but see, I thought you were going to mention Who Shot JFK, which is on some...
It's
on some other channel, and it's bringing basically bringing in the body parts from the presidential murder. I mean, all we want to talk about is how government really, really does things to people, but that may be too esoteric against JFK.
As someone who is disenchanted with party politics the way it is today, are you going to vote?
Yeah, I always vote. Sure. Look, everything makes a difference. Don't fall for the cynicism of nothing makes a difference. It will be different if Jerry Brown is in the White House next January instead of George Bush. It will be different if Bill Clinton is in the White House. And yes, it'll be somewhat different if Senator X is gone and Mrs. Jones has replaced him. You know what I mean? I mean, the problem with the present is... people have to be able to imagine beyond the present. They have to be able to imagine about what they might make possible by their own action. A vote today is disconnected. Elections do not deliver accountability. That is all true. But the answer is not to retreat to the couch. The answer is to begin building from quite modest origins in lots of different places the kinds of political relationships that will restore those things. And you can't do that by withdrawing from electoral politics.
Well, William Grider, I thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks.
William Grider is author of the new book, Who Will Tell the People? The Betrayal of American Democracy. And it's also the subject of his Frontline documentary, which will be shown Wednesday evening on public television. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Robert Altman launched Shelley Duvall's acting career over 20 years ago. She starred in his films Thieves Like Us, Three Women, and Popeye. And she starred in Stanley Kubrick's movie The Shining. But for the past few years, she spent more time producing than acting. For her Showtime cable series Fairy Tale Theater, she cast movie stars in classic fairy tales. Now she has a new animated series called Bedtime Stories. Coming up, we'll talk about acting and producing. And Maureen Carrigan reviews a new book about Westerns called West of Everything. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to federal mediators, United Auto Workers have agreed to end their five-month-old strike against Caterpillar and return to work. According to mediators, the union has agreed to return to work without conditions, and the company will end its efforts to hire replacements, with both parties agreeing to continue their talks. The announcement came this evening after 2 days of meetings with federal mediators. The five-month-long strike has idled thousands of workers at several plants in Illinois. President Bush campaigned in Michigan today, where he said that he will seek $50 million for a plan to streamline federal job training programs. Don Gagne reports.
The president, in an appearance before workers at an industrial machine manufacturing plant, described current government job training programs as a quilt of good intentions loaded with redundancies.
And with this jumble, is it any wonder that an 18-year-old fresh from high school doesn't know where to go for career guidance? Or that an unemployed older worker, eager to learn a new trade, is confused about how to find training?
He says his new program would provide one-stop shopping for those looking for training. The president made his remarks in Macomb County, a region known as the home of conservative Reagan Democrats who voted for Republicans in the last three presidential elections. Macomb County has been hard hit by auto industry layoffs, and many voters here say they aren't sure they'll support President Bush this time around. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
In New York City, a federal appeals court has upheld a 4-year prison term for former hotel executive Leona Helmsley on tax evasion charges, and she is to report to a prison hospital tomorrow in Kentucky. She said today on hearing the ruling that she accepts the court's judgment and is prepared to abide by the law. Jean Brian Johnson of member station WNYC reports.
Helmsley's lawyer argued that the original sentence, which was imposed in 1989, might have been fair at the time, but since then, the self-styled hotel queen's health had changed dramatically. Defense attorney Alan Dershowitz said the 4-year prison term was a virtual life sentence and had asked the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals to allow Mrs. Helmsley to do community service instead of going to jail. Prosecutors argued that since the 71-year-old Helmsley remains an active woman, allowing her to avoid prison would make a mockery of the law. Helmsley was convicted in 1989 of evading $1.7 million in taxes by billing personal expenses to companies the Helmsleys owned. For National Public Radio, this is Jean Brian Johnson in New York.
The government says that retail sales dropped 0.4% in March after gains in the two previous months. It was the biggest drop in 7 months. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 36 points to close at 3,306. This is NPR News. In Moscow, Russian President Boris Yeltsin has reached a compromise with Parliament, whereby his moves to a free market economy can continue. At the same time, his cabinet will not step down. The Congress of People's Deputies voted in favor of a measure that would allow Yeltsin to stay on as prime minister for at least 3 more months. At the same time, officials will be working on easing reforms by cutting taxes and upping wages and subsidies to industry. Another vote will be taken tomorrow in Parliament. The Bush administration has rallied behind Russian President Boris Yeltsin. Secretary of State Baker went out of his way today to emphasize that Yeltsin enjoys the full support of the U.S. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
Secretary of State Baker said Yeltsin is attempting something that is very courageous, trying to reform the entire system politically, socially, and economically. He predicted Yeltsin will be successful. Baker spoke at the State Department shortly after Yeltsin's government won a crucial victory in Parliament. Earlier in the day, Baker's spokeswoman had warned a reversal of Yeltsin's economic reforms could result in cuts in Western aid. In his comments to reporters, Baker also offered to participate in an international commission to oversee the destruction of Ukraine's nuclear weapons in Russia. Ukraine had stopped moving its tactical weapons into Russia, concerned Moscow would not destroy all of them. Today, though, Ukraine announced it would resume moving its weapons to Russia within days. It's not clear if Ukraine will take up the U.S. offer for verification. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
According to diplomats at the U.N., the U.S., Britain, and France have warned Iraq to stop all military activity and pull its missile batteries out of Kurdish areas. Reportedly, the warning also implied possible military action if Baghdad does not comply. Allied sources say Iraq has moved surface-to-air missiles into northern Iraq in recent months. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For years, Shelley Duvall was part of Robert Altman's repertory company of actors. She got her first role in his 1970 movie Brewster McCloud and went on to roles in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Thieves Like Us, Nashville, Three Women, and Popeye. She also starred in Stanley Kubrick's film The Shining. Shortly after playing Olive Oil in Popeye, Duvall started producing children's shows for cable TV, and ever since then she spent more time behind the camera than in front of it. For her first series, Fairy Tale Theater, she cast stars like Mick Jagger, Liza Minnelli, and Robin Williams in classic children's stories. Her new series, Bedtime Stories, features animated versions of children's books. The series premieres on Showtime April 21st. I asked Shelley Duvall how she convinced cable executives to give her a series when she had no experience as a producer.
Luckily, I was kind of well-known already as an actress, and I had done The Shining, and I was filming Popeye, and I had brought along a book of antique illustrated fairy tales with me, Grimm's Fairy Tales, to the location, which was on the island of Malta, and I figured I would definitely have time to read a book. I didn't have time to read the whole book of fairy tales, but I was reading The Frog Prince one day and thought that Robin Williams would just make a great frog. He was playing Popeye to my Olive Oil. And I talked to Robin about it, and he said, oh, I'd love that. That'd be great. I'd love to play the frog. And so I introduced him to my friend Eric Idle, who's one of the Monty Pythons, and boy, that was a match made in heaven. And when I got back to Los Angeles, I just went through my books of fairy tales and selected what actors would be great for the parts. You know, like, who would be your favorite choice of the stars that exist today for the roles of Cinderella or Snow White or, you know, any number of characters? So I made out a list of, you know, my wish list of different fairy tales and the cast of actors that I would like to have in them, and I put lots of my antique illustrated books into two big cloth bags, and I went walking in the door of Showtime and said, here's what I want to do. And they said yes. It was amazing to me, too. I mean, boy, they're trusting Olive Oil as a producer. I thought, well, that's risky. But and I'd never produced anything before, but I did have contacts with a lot of celebrities, luckily, and that was as a result of my acting career.
You haven't been making movies lately, and I'm wondering if that's because you're too busy with your other series or if it's for other reasons.
Well, I just haven't paid attention as much as I probably should have to continuing my acting career, but I have acted recently. As a matter of fact, I just went to New Zealand last month to star in a Ray Bradbury theater for USA Network.
Do you think that most casting directors assume that you're not available, and would that assumption be accurate?
Well, I think so, too, but you can put the word out right here and right now, I tell you, because I would love to. I mean, gosh, I go to the movie theater all the time. I love movies. I love watching them, and I see all these good roles. And every time I see one, I think, ooh, I would have loved to have played that role. But, you know, no matter how good somebody was in the role. But being a producer, I guess you get a view of the bigger picture. Well, and I love the fact that I can produce and still sleep in my own bed in my own home at night. You know, that I don't have. The Shining, for instance, was a year and 1 month of filming in London. So, and then Popeye, 6 months later, was 6 months of filming on the island of Malta in the middle of the Mediterranean. So after those two movies back to back, I felt like, gosh, if I could only have a house. Because I grew up in Texas, and I have this great desire to have put down roots, you know.
Could you tell
us? And I have a lot of animals. I have 70 birds and 11 dogs and 2 cats and several lizards. And
70 birds?
I feel, yep, 70, 7-0. And many of them are parrots. But listen, everything in my life, I draw from everything in my life. So I've, for instance, written a feature story about some of my birds, some of my parrots.
I have to stop you here. Do your parrots all say things? Do they all say different
things?
Oh,
yes, absolutely. My parrots talk all the time. It's very noisy at my house.
What do they say?
Particularly in the morning and in the evening. I have a parrot named Humpty, who's an Amazon, yellow-nape Amazon. And he is hilarious. He's like the Robin Williams of parrots. I mean, he'll hang upside down from one leg. You know, you think he's going to fall, and you run over there to catch him, and he goes, you know, he'll be calling out, help, help, you know. And you get there, and he goes, ah, ha, 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 and, you know, being the acrobat that he is, flips himself back up, upright, and, you know, no problem at all. It was no emergency, but he just wanted your attention. They all love songs, and they're all memorizing songs like Take Me Out to the Ball Game. That's a very popular tune at my house. And whistling things like the beginning of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. So they can whistle that one very good. They don't know the lyrics yet. But some songs they sing the lyrics and some they don't. But I'm on the telephone at home so much. I work a lot out of home on the computer, the fax, and the phone. And they hear me on the phone all the time. So Humpty also says, I taught him this routine too because it was just too funny to pass up. He goes, telephone, telephone, hello, oh, hi, how are you? Uh-huh, uh-huh, oh, fantastic, okay, bye-bye. He does that whole routine. It's hilarious. And I also taught him, two or three of the birds know this one. They know, how does a big dog go? Then he'll go, woof. Now, that's how a big dog goes. And then how does a kitty go? And he goes, meow.
What a house he
must
have.
I'm going to write some articles for Bird Talk magazine one of these days.
Let me change the subject and get into how you first started to act, which wasn't by design. Would you tell the story of how you were first cast in your first movie, Brewster McCloud, directed by Robert Altman?
Sure. Well, it all started with art, I guess. And my boyfriend at the time, I was 20 years old. I had just dropped out of a junior college. I decided to take a six-month rest from my science endeavors because I didn't like vivisection. And I was taking a break. And I gave a party for my boyfriend, who's an artist. And I was showing his paintings to just some friends of ours. And there were only about 20 people there. I mean, quite often we would give larger parties, and his parents' friends would come to our parties, and we and our friends would go to their parties. So it wasn't unusual one night when three men walked in whom I didn't know. And one of them said, after they saw the paintings and heard my spiel, they said, we have some patrons of the arts for friends. How would you like to bring the paintings up, say, Wednesday at 1 o'clock? I said, well, Bernard has to go back to art college outside of Dallas, so he won't be able to come, but okay, I'll do it. And I brought the paintings up Wednesday at 1 o'clock. My mom dropped me off, and I went through the whole speech about, you know, what the artist was thinking. And there were a lot of patronly-looking gentlemen sitting in a semicircle, and I figured, well, they must be legitimate art collectors. And instead of saying at the end of my speech, instead of saying, we want this one and this one and this one, they said, quote, unquote, how would you like to be in a movie? And I thought, uh-oh, oh, no, porno. So I started packing up. I was scared to death. I thought, oh, my gosh, my mother's going to kill me. My father's going to kill me. I'm really scared. So I started packing up, and I was rushing toward the door with the paintings. And I had one hand on the doorknob and the other one with the portfolio under my arm. And they said, well, wait a minute, this is for real. This is for MGM, you know, the lion that roars. And this is Robert Altman, who just did the movie called MASH, which opens today. Would you like 10 free tickets? And they said, I took the tickets, by the way. And they said, well, wait a minute, just give us a telephone number where we can reach you. And let us take a Polaroid picture. So the Polaroid is, of course, with me with one hand on the doorknob ready to leave. And I wish I still had that picture. And the telephone number I decided to give them just in case was my father's office phone number. Now, my dad's a criminal lawyer. I figure if they can get past my dad, they must be legitimate.
So when you started acting, was this something that you secretly always wanted to do but never thought that you could? Or was it something that you couldn't care less about?
Yeah, I looked at movies as paintings. You know, they were beautiful, and I didn't think I was an artist. I mean, I didn't know. Actually, I didn't think this was a career until after I had finished my third film, which was also for Robert Altman. I've done 7 films with Robert Altman, and the last of which being Popeye, which was an unlikely choice for him. But
that third film that you mentioned was Thieves Like Us,
Thieves
right?
Like Us, uh-huh.
Actress and producer Shelley Duvall is my guest. Her new cable series, Bedtime Stories, premieres this month on Showtime. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Actress and producer Shelley Duvall is my guest. One of your best-known movies, The Shining, was directed by Stanley Kubrick, who I think in some ways is probably opposite in style to Robert Altman in the sense that every shot is really well-planned in advance.
Oh, yes.
You know, carefully storyboarded. Everything's, like, very meticulously planned. With Altman, I know there's a lot of spontaneity and improvisation.
Oh, Robert Altman's famous for his wonderful first takes. You know, many, many, many shots in his films are first takes and one and only takes.
And with Kubrick?
And with Kubrick, I don't think anything's printed before the 35th take. And that's after about 50 videotaped rehearsals with playback. So it was a very, very difficult experience for me to change over to that style. Plus, the nature of the role was that I had to be very upset for most of the film. So for 9 months out of that 1 year and 1 month of shooting, I had to be crying and hysterical and hyperventilating. And that's physically almost impossible to do. I did do it. I don't think that I could ever do it again. I had to cry. He expected full tears on first rehearsal. And I kept trying to explain to him, Stanley, you don't understand. I'm losing all my water weight here. I mean, more water weight than I have to give. And, you know, it really wouldn't be that way in real life.
What did you do to get the tears flowing? I mean, it's one thing to once a night on stage
Oh, I'm sorry. I have a favorite classical piece of music that I listen to cry, and it's a beautiful, beautiful piece by Sir Thomas Tallis. It's called The Lark Ascending, and he's an English composer, and it's performed by St. Martin in the Fields, conducted by Neville Mariner. And if you have that in your collection, you could play it. It's absolutely gorgeous. And I listened to that, and when that violin would hit those higher notes, it worked every time, except for a few times when I just literally dried up. I was so exhausted. But that was a very difficult film for me. I mean, Jack and I both got kind of ill from the smoke that they were using. They were using church incense to smoke up the room, you know, the grand room where Jack chases me around with
the knife.
With the baseball. Well, it culminates in me hitting him with the baseball bat. It's the grand room with a grand piano in it, and where all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. That scene.
Oh yeah, I love that scene.
which was on the call sheet for 3 weeks. We shot that for 3 weeks. It was all done with the Steadicam, all in one shot, and that was a very, very difficult time. But we both got bronchitis from that.
Now, I believe that you turned down Robert Altman once for a wedding, that you turned down a role in the film.
Yes, I did. I had plans, and I had rented a house, and it would have meant losing my summer and losing the plans that I had made and losing the money that I'd put up on the house. So I figured, better not. You know, you can't lose your perspective on life there. You know, I won't do anything for a job.
One last question. Have you ever gotten Robert Altman to do anything on your cable series?
No, I haven't. Bob's always been busy. I mean, right when I was doing Fairy Tale Theater, he went to France to produce films. So he was gone quite a while. Moved his production offices to France and everything. And I was so busy here producing Fairy Tale Theater. You know, we didn't have the money to fly people in from Europe very often. And certainly not a director. I mean, really, we would only fly in a star.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at one point, I got a phone call. I got a message, you know, my assistant came in and said, Shelley, I don't know if this is for real or not, but Fellini's on the phone. And I went, no way, no way. And it was. It's the most incredible thing. I was like, Fellini, you know. Oh, he's fantastic. I mean, he's one of my heroes. But we didn't have the money to bring him over to film one. And the insurance and, you know, and making all the arrangements politically so that he could enter the country and work in California, you know, what with all the union rules and everything. I was like, oh, what a disappointment that was. But who knows, maybe someday.
Shelley Duvall, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Shelley Duvall produced and hosts the new animated series Bedtime Stories. It premieres on Showtime April 21st. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we have a number of really interesting pieces on today, but one of the most fascinating is Mike Schuster's trip to Siberia. He was in Yakutia, which is a new republic as far north as Anchorage, way out on the edge of Russia. We also are marking the anniversary of the U.S. bombing of Libya. Libya was before the World Court, and a decision has been handed down there. The Los Angeles Police Department trial is about to go to closing arguments. Wendy Kaufman will be catching us up on that. We'll hear from the folks in Chicago about how they're surviving the flood, and we'll talk to a very thoughtful congressman from Minnesota, Vin Weber, who's decided not to run again.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For her new book, West of Everything, Jane Tompkins studied loads of Western films, everything from Stagecoach to Dances with Wolves. She also visited the Buffalo Bill Museum in Coney, Wyoming, and read the collected works of authors like Zane Grey and Louis L'Amour. Critic Maureen Carrigan says Tompkins has come up with some provocative interpretations of Westerns.
What makes a man to wonder? What makes a man to roam? What makes a man leave bed and board and turn his back on home? Right away.
That's the theme music from John Ford's 1956 masterpiece, The Searchers. The music sets the grim tone for an opening scene that's just like the opening scene of almost every other Western ever made. First, there's a shot of a rocky desert landscape. Then a lone rider appears, a man as hard as the land itself. Over the next 2 hours, a ritual drama unfolds that'll include all or some of the following. A young woman who loves the hero and talks way too much about her feelings. The hero's male sidekick and unconscious true love interest, who usually dies violently. lots of Indians, cattle, and horses that are forced to submit to the cowboy's will, and at the center of the story, a gunfight or some other rigidly choreographed dance with death that displaces everything else to the meaningless periphery of the story. Although the Western is no place for a lady, critical sharpshooter Jane Tompkins has roamed far and wide throughout its hostile territory. Unlike some other popular culture theorists who discuss their subjects with all the enthusiasm of nutritionists dissecting a hot dog, Tompkins is a genuine fan. You get the sense that taking notes on reruns of Hopalong Cassidy wasn't exactly a scholarly chore for her. Tompkins' great achievement in West of Everything is that even when she discusses the genre's codes of silence, violence, and misogyny, she doesn't sound like a prissy schoolmarm lecturing a rowdy cowboy. Throughout her book, Tompkins considers some crucial questions about the Western. Why is the hero attracted to pain? Why does he fear women? And why is it that a real cowboy never utters a discouraging word, nor much of anything else? In this conversation, again from The Searchers, the young hero returns to the woman he loves and is shocked to find out that she's about to get hitched to somebody else.
But I wrote you one letter.
One letter in 5 years. I read it till the paper dried up and the writing faded out.
Yeah. This is, wasn't much of a letter, was it?
No, it wasn't. I'd at least said you loved me. You might ask me to wait for you. At least that'd have been something.
But I always loved you. I thought you knew that without me having to say it.
Tompkins claims that the reasons for the Western's spare, harsh style lie buried deep within the sexual subtext of the genre. She says the Western doesn't have anything to do with the West as such. It's about men's fear of losing their mastery and hence their identity, both of which the Western tirelessly reinvents. That makes sense to me, but every so often Tompkins gets carried away and sounds like she's chewed a few peyote buttons on her trip west. For instance, Tompkins suggests that cattle are the great unconscious in Western movies, and she implicitly likens Midwestern stockyards to concentration camps. But this animal rights riff is only a brief detour in her book. Tompkins knows that violence is a big part of the Western's appeal, even to her, and she doesn't set out to civilize this untamed genre. Instead, Tompkins turns her unflinching, Gary Cooper-like gaze on everything that makes the Western popular, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Maureen Carrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed West of Everything by Jane Tompkins. More about the Western and the West tomorrow when we talk with Wallace Degner. We'd love to hear your comments about Fresh Air, so give us a call on our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Voblaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Writer Wallace Degner describes the remaining wilderness of the Western United States as the geography of hope. He grew up in the West when the century was young and the West was more wide open. On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Wallace Degner about living and writing in the West. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
minus, the high tomorrow in the mid to upper 50s. The time now,